It's been about 2 months now since we celebrated the fall feast days and rejoiced in all, you know, that God reveals to us through those days. We were inspired and uplifted, encouraged by the hope of being a part of God's kingdom, encouraged by the hope of being able to help Christ restore all things and to bring countless people, you know, to help to bring countless people into God's family. But now, we're back in this sad, dark world that is temporarily under the rule of Satan, who, to put it mildly, does not like us. You know, it is part of our nature that sometimes we can forget that he wants to do everything that he can to keep us from becoming the spirit-born children of God, living in that fantastic, wonderful world that God is preparing for us. Revelation 12 and verse 10 tells us that Satan accuses us, you know, day and night before God. And unfortunately, we give him plenty of things to complain about. And I've often suspected that he has conversations with God about us, just like he did with Job, asking for permission to test us by hurting us in whatever way that, you know, he can, whatever way that God will allow. I say that because over the years, as I've watched the trials that God's people have gone through, they all tend to fall into the same areas as those that Satan inflicted on Job. You know, there are trials of security, like the loss of income or a car or a job or a home. There are trials of family and friends, like suffering and untimely or painful deaths, or problems in our relationships, often because of our relationship with God. And then there are the trials of health. You know, those three basic areas. And at some time or another, we all experience them. Sometimes it feels like we're being picked on. And that may be very, very true. You know, as Christ warned Peter and the other disciples in Luke chapter 22 and verse 31, about Satan's wanting to sift them and thrash them like wheat, we have to realize that Satan wants to make our lives as hard and as unpleasant as he can, not just because he hates us, but also because he wants to discourage us. He wants to make us feel that life and even God is not fair to us. He wants to turn us away from God. You know, and if it were not for God helping us, he would succeed far more often than he does. You know, Satan is very powerful, and he delights in causing suffering. But that's not the only way that he tries to damage our relationship with God. In Deuteronomy chapter 8, God reminds the children of Israel, I'm trying to find there, that he is going to bring them into a blessed land. But then he warns them that the blessings can also be a trial. Let's start reading in verse 7. Deuteronomy chapter 8, verse 7. For the Eternal your God is bringing you into a good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains and springs that flow out of the valleys and the hills, a land of wheat and barley, of vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive oil and honey, a land in which you will eat bread without scarcity, in which you will lack nothing, a land whose stones are iron and out of whose hills you can dig copper. You know, he gave them a wonderful goal of a beautiful and prosperous land. You know, a land very different from the way it is today. And he gives us an even greater goal, goal of the new heavens, the new earth, New Jerusalem. You know, that he is preparing us and bringing us toward. But as he warned Israel, you know, the warning also applies to us. Verse 10. When you have eaten and are full, and you shall bless the Eternal your God for the good land which he has given you. And beware that you do not forget the Eternal your God by not keeping his commandments, his judgments, and his statutes, which I command you this day. I'm going to read through 14 or more. Okay, lest when you have eaten and are full and have built beautiful houses and dwell in them, and when your herds and your flocks multiply, and your silver and your gold are multiplied, and all that you have is multiplied, when your heart is lifted up, and you forget that the Eternal your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage, who led you through that great and terrible wilderness. We're in one of those, aren't we? In which there were fiery serpents and scorpions and a thirsty land where there was no water. Who brought water for you out of the flinty rock. And then verse 16, which has some very important things in it. Who fed you in the wilderness with manna, which your fathers did not know, that he might humble you, and that he might test you to do you good in the end. Then you say in your heart, my power and the might of my hand have gained me this wealth. And you shall remember that the Eternal your God, and you shall remember the Eternal your God, for it is he who gives you power to get wealth, that he may establish his covenant which he swore to your fathers, as it is this day. You know, the covenant which he gives to us also, that we may be his people, and we and he will be our God. God warned them about the danger of having many blessings, because Satan will use our abundance to get us to ignore our relationship with God. Remember in verses 14 and 16, God reminded ancient Israel of all that he had done for them as he brought them out of Egypt to the promised land. He also reminded them that he did what he did so that they could eventually be blessed, and blessed in far more than just a physical land of plenty. You know, when we read examples like that, we should think about our personal calling and what we have experienced in this life. We need to understand that all we go through is used by God to humble us, that he might test us and do us good in the end. So what he said to them applies to us. All the trials and all the joyous times we go through in this life are used by God to help prepare us to become spirit beings in his kingdom. They help us to truly understand the flaws in our human nature that must be replaced by God's very nature of deep, loving concern for all others. You know, it's all part of our training as his potential children, part of our rearing. But we also have to understand that Satan is also trying to use these same trials and these same times of joy that we experienced to turn us away from God. How does he do that? Well, the Bible gives us three basic ways that he works on us. We get a hint of one of those in verse 17, where it said, "Then you shall say in your heart, my power and the might of my hand have gained me this wealth." You know, Satan uses his subtle lies, lies that often start out seemingly to be of no importance, to seduce us into believing that it is our talent and our hard work that gets us the things that we want in this life, and that we deserve to have those things that we want, and we deserve to have even more. He also encourages us to believe that if we do not get what we want, we're not being treated fairly by somebody, perhaps even by God. So let's look at a couple of very familiar examples of how he did this to people, you know, in God's word. Let's start in Genesis 3, which is the classic example. Genesis 3, starting in verse 1. And we're going to read through verses 1 to 5. Genesis 3 says, "Now the serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field which the eternal God had made. And he said to the woman, 'Has God indeed said, you shall not eat of every tree of the garden?' And the woman said to the serpent, 'We may eat the fruit of the trees of the garden. But the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God has said, you shall not eat it, nor shall you touch it, lest you die.' And then the serpent said to the woman, 'You will not surely die. For God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil.'" Let's think about what's going on here. Satan asks a question that contains or suggests doubt. Did God tell you that, you know, not to eat of the fruit of the trees of this garden? You know, to which Eve said, "No, that's not what God told us. He said we could eat of all the fruit, except that which is on the tree of the knowledge of good and evil." So Eve knew what God taught them. Today we might say that she understood the teachings or the doctrines of the church. Or as it used to be said in the church a number of years ago, she could talk the talk. So Satan was not trying to use facts and logic or intellectual arguments to convince her. You know, remember, Satan's first question twisted and cast doubts upon what God had taught her. It was intended to play on her emotions, you know, to create that doubt, to shake her trust in what God had said to them. Then Satan responds to Eve by answering, he responds to Eve's answer by casting doubt on God's integrity and on God's motives. He caused Eve to question God and what God had taught them. And you know, he tries to do the same thing to us. Plays on our emotions and starts with little things. He told her, you know, "That's not so. You will not die." You know, which was a subtle twisting of the truth. Because although, you know, it would bring death, it wouldn't bring it immediately. He said, "God only told you that because he knows that if you eat of the fruit of the tree, you will get knowledge and you will be like God, able to decide for yourself what is good for you and what is not." You know, he was implying that God was keeping them from having something they should be entitled to. He was implying that God was keeping them from gaining knowledge and wisdom and therefore power. You know, some commentaries that I read recently say that Satan, that his comments were intended to make Eve think that God was jealous of what, you know, they could become, and thus make her feel that God was not fair to her. In truth, we know that it is Satan who is jealous of what we can become, and that he cares nothing about fairness or what we should be entitled to. He only wants to hurt us. You know, verse 6 is important because it reveals three fruits or three ways that Satan uses to pull us away from God. And verse 6 is one that's on two different pages. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food and that it was stuck together, pleasant to the eyes, and a tree desirable to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate, and she also gave to her husband with her, and he ate. You know, have you ever wondered how Eve saw that the tree was good for food and not deadly poison? Did Satan eat of the tree and then sneer at her for believing God? Or did he cause a deer or a monkey or some other animal to come up and eat of the fruit as she and Adam watched and then laugh at her confusion when an animal did not die? You know, someday we'll be able to ask Christ exactly what happened. How exactly did she come to see that they wouldn't die if they touched or ate that fruit immediately? Anyway, something convinced Eve, you know, that she would not die if she ate of that fruit. And when that happened, she saw that the fruit was something pleasant. The Hebrew for pleasant actually means a longing or a delight. She looked at it and longed to have it. She felt it would give her pleasure, a delight. She came to believe Satan's lie that the tree would give her wisdom and power. And as a result, she disobeyed what she knew God had told her and Adam not to do. You know, it may seem like a simple child story, but actually it tells us how Satan uses his three favorite ways of luring us into doing things that cause us to sin and to damage our relationship with God. Satan deceived Eve by talking to her in person. Today, he hides, and he works his seductions through the words, the ideas, and the actions of people. When Paul was talking to the Corinthians about men who were trying to teach them, things that contradicted what Paul and the other apostles had learned from Jesus Christ, he said this in 2 Corinthians chapter 11. 2 Corinthians 11, read verses 14 and 15. Did I have the right one? Well, let's get in the right book. 11, 14 and 15. When you get older, it's harder to turn the pages. 14 and 15. Well, 13. For such are false prophets, deceitful workers, transforming themselves into apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for Satan himself transforms himself into an angel of light. Therefore, it's no great thing if his ministers also transform themselves into ministers of righteousness, whose end will be according to their work. You know, Satan delights in sending his message to us through good people in many ways. You know, it can come from people we work with or go to school with or read about or what people say on the internet, etc., etc. You know, what Paul said here does not just apply to people who might try to lead us astray religiously. It applies to how we get information every day in this world that Satan rules. Information that affects how we live and react with other people. Everything, you know, that Satan sends our way is intended to work on one of those three ways that he used to draw Eve away from her fear of disobeying God. The Apostle John actually labels these tools of Satan for us in 1 John chapter 2. I'm going to do, as I did last time, a lot of scriptures today. God says things much better than I can. Okay. 1 John chapter 2 and verse 16. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. Three things. The first, lust of the flesh. In the world that we live in, we tend to think of this as sexual lust, but actually, it's far more than that. It actually can include anything that involves our physical or emotional desires that we do not control. Eve saw that the tree was good for food. A wrong desire for food or any physical thing, you know, that's needed for our life is a problem for many people. You know, Russia wanted the natural resources of Ukraine. And look at all the suffering and death that that uncontrolled desire has caused. Anger is also a lust of the flesh. Anger was behind Cain's sin. In Genesis 4, starting in verse 6, after Cain's offering was rejected, Cain was wroth, or very angry. And God questioned him and warned him that his attitude of anger could lead to sin and that he had to control it. Unfortunately, we know he didn't, and he wound up killing his brother. He let his envy and his resentment grow till it became anger and bitterness and a lust for revenge that led to murder. And Satan laughs. Poking at our emotions to stir up anger is still a common way that Satan seduces us to sin. So if we're not very careful, we can easily find ourselves getting angry before we realize what's happening. And that's why we need to control, to question our negative emotions before they can grow into, you know, and become anger or even bitterness and a desire, a lust for revenge. The second was the lust of the eyes. Eve saw that the tree was pleasant, and that made her desire to have it. Remember that the word translated pleasant means a longing, a delight. It looked beautiful. It enticed her and made her long for the delights that it seemed to offer. You know, we've been told many times that today's advertising is actually based on this. In the 10 years that I worked in merchandising, doing things in stores, you know, to get people to see and to long for the various products, I was shown how important, you know, the package design and color and even the placement on the shelves are in drawing the eye and creating a longing that will overcome the resistance that a customer might have, to make the customer believe that they would be delighted to have that product. It also reminds me of a scene in the play that Sights and Sounds did of Ruth, which we saw at the feast in Lancaster a few years ago. There's a copy of it, DVD, in the library. Naomi and her family had just arrived in Moab, which at the time was much more prosperous than Israel. And the street vendor was going by displaying all these beautiful things, holding them up and waving them. And he was singing, "See how pretty. You want it. You need it. You want it. You need it." You know, he was using the lust of the eyes to create a longing, a desire, so that people would buy his product, even if they did not need it. And it's the same in our world today. Unfortunately, the lust of the eyes can seduce people into spending money they can't afford or don't even have. It can lead people to steal or to sin in other ways to try to get the delight that the lust of the eyes falsely promises. The third thing is the pride of life. And I think a simple way of defining this is to say that it is an elevated opinion of our self-importance. It's a desire to be viewed as special or important because of what or who we are, or what we know, or at least what we think we are and what we know. It's a desire to gain more power or influence, more recognition and admiration. You know, this was Satan's original weakness. When he looked at his beauty and his musical talents and the wisdom that God had given him, and he felt that he should be more than just one of the three highest ranking angels. He desired to raise himself up above God. He wanted to be God. And he still thinks that his way of life is better than God's, and that God the Father and Christ should be removed. He thinks that we humans, you know, who are little less than the lowest ranking angels, have no right to become children more glorious and powerful than he is. So he wants to destroy us. And without God helping us and protecting us every single day, he probably would. And that's why, you know, it is so important for us to always be close to our God and to be under his protection. Those three character flaws that John listed for us are the underlying motives that drive this world outside of those whom God calls to be his first fruits. There are also drives that Satan uses to try to seduce us away from God and into sin. Remember it said, for all that is in the world. You know, God inspired John to say all, and he means all. Every aspect of this world that man, you know, has created by following Satan and Satan's way, from our economic systems, all the various political systems that man has tried throughout the ages, all the various social systems with their many ways of relating and caring for other people, all, everything in the world around us, you know, is founded on those three principles of Satan's selfish, competitive way of thinking and living. Everything the world encourages us to strive for, that it tells us we deserve, that we must have, it's all, you know, rooted and motivated by one of those three desires to get for the self. And frankly, when you try to look at any specific problem or any specific sin, you will often find that all three of those things are involved, and they all tend to work together. It is easy to say that most of the time, the first two lead to pride of life. You know, with some desire or emotion that's focused on the self, it may be, it may even be a desire for something that we actually need, not just a want. And sometimes it could be a threat to our security, like, you know, fear of losing a job, or it could be something involving a threat to a loving relationship or a threat to our health. Three areas that Satan loves to pick on us at. Just like he did with Job, Satan often will take these needs and tell us that it's not fair that we have to suffer those things. It's not fair to us that someone or the government or God is not letting us have what we need, what we deserve. And that can be a very powerful motivator for us to do something, you know, trying to use our own power and our own abilities to promote ourselves, to get what we want, or to lash out at whoever seems to be threatening us unfairly. That's the way the world is. But what does God tell us to do? Well, a lot of things. But one of them, for example, is in Matthew 6, starting in verse 31. Matthew 6:31. It's a familiar passage. Thought occurred to me. I wonder what prompted that particular conversation to come up with the disciples. There we are. Anyway, they were talking about the need for physical things and whatever. And we're going to read through verse 33. Therefore, this is Christ speaking to them. He said, do not worry, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or what shall we wear? You know, don't worry about all those physical things. For after all these things, the Gentiles seek. For your heavenly Father knows that you need all these things. But seek you first the kingdom of God. Of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. You know, in this passage where it says the Gentiles, I think today we can think of that as people who do not believe God's word. People who have not yet been called into a relationship with our God, or we could say the world. Their lives are almost totally focused on getting the things, that physical things that they feel they need and desire. Well, you also have to include in that not just the physical things, but the admiration and the respect of others that, you know, they want. They feel that they get these things by their abilities and that they deserve to have even more. It's part of our twisted, satanic human nature to desire to lift ourselves up in the eyes of other people. And God knows we need things, but he wants us to seek them within the framework of his righteousness. He knows what we need, and he will give us what we need. You know, just a few verses before this, around verse 9, Jesus told us that we are to pray to our Father for our daily needs. If he already knows what we need, why are we told to ask every single day? Let me suggest that he asks us to do that so we do not forget that it is God who gives us all that we need, even though we still have to use the strengths and the abilities, again, which he gave us, and then work to get those needs. You know, recognizing God's hand working in our lives is a major tool that helps us resist the pride, you know, that makes us think, you know, that we did it on our own and that we are special. Now, we need to constantly be looking for the blessings that God does in our lives and then thank him for it. That's a tremendous bit of protection for us. The world looks at pride, especially this kind of pride, as something that is good. They call it self-esteem, self-reliance, or an independent nature. God just calls it pride. And he says that it leads us into trying to lift ourselves above others and into doing things that he knows will harm us. Remember, Eve saw that the tree was desired to make one wise. Does God not want us to become wise, to seek knowledge and wisdom? Actually, he does want us to seek knowledge and wisdom. But it must be within a framework that will not harm us. That actually means within a framework of God's righteousness, within the framework of his laws, you know, that show us God's way of living. Let's look at some proverbs that talk about pride. Proverbs 25 and verse 2. Well, this one tells us that God does want us to seek. Proverbs 25 and verse 2. It is the glory of God to conceal a thing, but it is the honor of a king to search out a matter. Remember, we are being trained to be kings and priests. God wants us to use our minds to think and to learn right things, things that will help other people and that will honor our Father. In Proverbs 9 and verse 10, we're told, the fear of the Eternal is the beginning of wisdom, And the knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. You know, this is the basis of knowledge and wisdom that God wants us to learn. When God begins to call us and we respond in a positive way, learning to respect and to stand in awe of Him and His laws, we grow in knowledge and wisdom. You know, God is only trying to keep us from knowledge of evil that harms us. In Proverbs chapter 1 and verse 7, another familiar verse says, "The fear of the eternal is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction." They despise God's wisdom, and they want false wisdom that comes from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And it comes through those three: lust of the eye, lust of the flesh, and the pride of life. You know, mankind thinks they can study the world and the universe and decide for themselves what is best, what is true for me. In other words, mankind believes Satan's lie that we can, you know, that we do not need God to tell us how we should live. They can be a God to themselves and decide what is good and what is not. And it might change tomorrow. Yet God tells us that we cannot begin to understand until we respect and stand in awe of Him and His Word. Deuteronomy 29. Deuteronomy. This is one that when I saw this as I was preparing the message, I thought, oh, you know, I should mark that in my Bible. That one's a good one to remember. Deuteronomy 29:29 says, "The secret things belong to our God, but those things which are revealed belong to us and to our children forever." And why? "That we may do all the words of His law." God says there are some things we do not need to know, like how to create an atom, or a planet, or a universe, or how to make war and steal from other people and kill those who might resist us. We do not need to know how to take to ourselves honor and position because we feel we deserve it. You know, God does not want us to learn to be like Satan. And in this verse, He gives us a start to show us how to resist, you know, how to resist Satan's three principles. A second one, actually, because we looked at one already. If we're willing, when God calls us and He begins to open our minds to His truth, He will reveal things to us so that we can live by His words, you know, by the principles of His law, which protects us from Satan and Satan's, you know, principles of selfish living. He draws us, God does, to Him and to the tree of life. And He reveals to us how to resist Satan. You know, to resist Satan by properly doing or living by all the words of His law. Some of the things, excuse me, I should have had another fisherman's friend here, I guess. Anyway, some of the things that He reveals to us or why we even exist. You know, his plan to bring us into his eternal family as his children. And within that plan, he also reveals he reveals to us how we can learn to live, or as we read, do all the words of his law. And that, you know, that covers a whole lifetime of learning, and it covers a whole book. So we're only going to look at a very little bit right here today. Okay, we saw earlier that pride was the cause of Satan's sin. So let's look at some of what God has to say about pride. In James chapter 4, James chapter 4 and verse 6, James 4 and verse 6, we read, "But he," that is God, "gives more grace. Therefore, he says, God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble." You know, this is probably the most quoted verse on pride in the Bible. It tells us that God does not bless pride, but he does bless humility. Peter says basically the same thing, but he applies it to our relationships. 1 Peter 5 and verse 5. Peter says, 1 Peter 5 and verse 5, "Likewise, you younger people, submit yourselves to your elders." "Yes, all of you, be submissive one to another, and be clothed with humility." For, he quotes the same thing again, "God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble." You know, not only does pride keep us from God's blessing, it makes it harder for us to submit to each other and thus to have true loving relationships. I'm not going to read it, but Proverbs 13:10 gives us one reason why that, well, I am going to read it. I will read that one. Proverbs 13:10 shows us one reason why that is. I have about 5 bookmarks, and you'd think I'd have all these spots marked, but I don't. Proverbs 13:10 says, "By pride comes nothing but strife, but with the well-advised is wisdom." You know, pride leads to quarrels, to backbiting, and to gossip. Let me quote something that I read in a UCG United News article entitled "Treasure Digest, Humility and Pride." The author says, "Pride spawns conceit, jealousy, fear, and blame. Pride accuses and condemns. It supports lying, greed, hate, and unrighteousness." Not hard to see why God doesn't like pride. You know, and whenever we see the beginnings of these traits in our lives, we need to realize that Satan is trying to lure us into the pride of life. A big problem is that pride also can blind us to its very presence in our lives. You know, it can make us feel that we're right. Proverbs 16:2 is the one that I was just going to mention and not read, because that's the one that tells us that pride can blind us to its, you know, to its very presence in our lives. That verse also tells us that God is watching our hidden motives. You know, because self-deception can easily happen, we need to be turning to God in forgiveness and seeking the help, you know, to overcome any weakness that we can see in ourselves as soon as we possibly can. That also does say, you know, if you're going to ask his help, you have to look for the things where you need his help. An easy way to do that is ask yourself whenever you think you might see something in your behavior that might not be right, that might be Satan tempting you, ask yourself, is this honoring me or is it honoring God? If it's honoring us more than God, we know we need to ask his help to get rid of it. You know, there are a number of examples in the Bible that we could look to to see, you know, how people would see things in their lives, see a mistake, see a sin, and then change, like David, which we've done many times, or like King Hezekiah. But we know, and we don't have a lot of time anyway, we know that we have the assurance of Christ, his sacrifice, and God's promise to forgive us. So rather than do that, let me just suggest this, that we actually take some time this coming week and look at our own lives and maybe the people around us and see how well we can spot and reject Satan's attempts to lure us into pride and into sin. Remember, Christ tells us that part of our daily prayer should be, remember, forgive me as I forgive others. You know, as I forgive those who others who have tried to hurt me. Let's go back to Proverbs 13 a minute and just think about, I want to think about that last part of the verse where it says, but with the well-advised is wisdom. You know, people who humble themselves and listen to the advice and correction from God or from other people, it says, are wise. That means they learn the right thing to do, and then they do it. And that's very important, because in Isaiah 66, chapters 1 and 2, God tells us that that's what he's looking for in us, is that we grow in godly wisdom and humility. 66, and starting in verse 1. Verses 1 and 2. Thus says the Eternal, heaven is my throne, and the earth my footstool. Where is the house that you will build for me, and where is the place of my rest? For all these things my hand has made, and all these things exist. He keeps them existing, says the Eternal. But on this one will I look, on him who is poor and of a contrite spirit and who trembles at my word. God is the source of all power, the creator of everything that exists, both physical and spiritual. And he keeps everything functioning, working the way it's supposed to. He keeps us living. He gives us every breath we breathe, every heartbeat. God is not impressed by power. You know, Satan's power, his beauty, his talent, which are much greater than any human's, are nothing compared to God. God considers pride, the lifting up or promoting of the self, to be detestable because of all the harm that it causes. And we looked at a number of those things that it does already. It's the opposite of everything that God is. Pride is selfishness. Rather, God looks to the person who humbly looks to him and strives to follow his way of living as explained through his laws. Humility is at the core of our relationship with God. But what does that actually mean? Well, let me start with this explanation. In God's eyes, humility would be to truly and deeply recognize how awesome and powerful and yet loving our God is. Humility is always looking to and giving God the credit, never lifting ourselves up or taking credit, you know, for what God makes it possible for us to do. It involves understanding of who we are and how weak and how prone to making mistakes we are. Humility involves the understanding and the accepting that everything we have and are and can be comes from God. It involves truly understanding and trusting that as God told the captive Jews in Jeremiah 29, verse 11, he only wants what's best for us. You know, he wants to give us, like Christ said, it's his desire to give us the kingdom. I want to read Jeremiah 29, 11. It says, "For I know the thoughts that I think toward you, says the Eternal, thoughts of peace and not of evil, to give you an expected end." You know, he wanted to give Israel peace and joy in their own land. He wants to give us, as I said, his kingdom, the new heavens, the new earth, something that's beyond, I think, what we can even grasp. But humility helps us to accept the fact that the things that God reveals to us, including his laws, are meant to protect us. You know, God willingly reveals to us awesome things that the world cannot understand. Things about his purpose for us in order to inspire and to motivate us to stay away from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, away from its seductive pulls, you know, of Satan's three principles of living for the self. Or rather, God encourages us to constantly look to him, you know, for all our needs, including forgiveness for our mistakes. Remember, he said, you know, as I read before, give us our daily bread. And forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. So much of our lives revolves around those things. And if we humbly and sincerely do this, remembering that all we have, all we are and hope to be is from God, giving him the credit and the honor, you know, we will be able to resist Satan's attempts to lure us with that lust of the flesh, lust of the eye, and pride of life. We will not only be able to resist, we will be prepared, brethren, to be with Christ in his kingdom, bringing all of the wonderful things that we've been taught to countless other people and preparing them also to reject Satan's ways and to become part of God's family.